The causes of the European Reformation of the 16th century used to be very simple and straightforward. The Reformation, it was argued, was an inevitable protest against a corrupt and oppressive church. Across Europe, ordinary people, the laity or layfolk, were put upon by the Catholic clergy, both financially and spiritually, and they didn't like it. Lay people were forced to attend services in a language they didn't understand, Latin, and they had little or no opportunity to inform themselves about the true meanings of their Christian faith, since the Bible was not made available to them in their own tongue. They were entirely dependent on the rituals or sacraments offered by priests in order to be saved. These priests were a caste set apart. They had a distinctive appearance, with special clothes and shaven heads, and their superior purity was marked by the fact that they lived lives of celibacy. But in practice, many of them were worldly and grasping, and celibate only in theory. Parish priests and monasteries also demanded and received tithes, a compulsory income tax of 10% that all lay people had to pay. Small wonder that all this produced resentment, anti-clericalism, and a yearning for something different. Meanwhile, the political authorities in much of Western Europe, whether kings of England or Sweden, or the rulers of the many small princely states in Germany, found their political ambitions blocked by the power of the church in their lands and the interference of the Pope in Rome. Throughout this period, monarchs were centralizing and modernizing, turning a jumble of territories and jurisdictions into something like a modern nation-state. But the traditional so-called liberties claimed by the church were an obstacle to this. The church ran its own parallel system of law, canon law, with its own courts. And it insisted that misbehaving priests could only be called to account there and should be exempt from the ordinary or secular courts. As well as being spiritual leaders, bishops were major and powerful landowners, so if they were loyal to the Pope and appointed by him, they were potentially unreliable subjects to their king. Church and state were thus set on a collision course, a long-standing conflict resolved by the Reformation. Western Europe, in other words, was a kind of powder keg, waiting for the spark which would set it alight, and that spark was provided by a courageous religious dissident, Martin Luther. But we need to stop here for a moment, because this picture of the causes of the Reformation is at best too simplistic, and at worst, highly misleading. It is, in fact, the version that Protestants themselves told about their own history for several centuries. But the duty of historians is to challenge traditional and accepted explanations, and this one has been thoroughly challenged over the last few years. Church-state conflicts certainly were a periodic feature of late medieval life, but there is no particular sign that they were getting worse in the run-up to the Reformation. Some of the fiercest quarrels between kings and popes had actually taken place centuries earlier, such as the German Emperor Henry IV's conflict with Pope Gregory VII in the 11th century, or King John of England's falling out with Innocent III in the 13th. In some ways, relationships between secular rulers and the papacy were getting easier in the century or so preceding the Reformation. This was because the popes of the Renaissance period were not nearly as powerful as Gregory VII or Innocent III had been. They were forced to spend much of their time and energy consolidating their power in central Italy, particularly after the French invasion of the Italian peninsula in 1494. As a result, they were prepared to grant secular rulers, in practice, if not always in theory, a considerable amount of power over the churches in their territories. Local bishops were officially appointed by the Pope, but were usually nominated by the kings of France, England, or Spain, who took the opportunity to appoint their own reliable servants to the posts. In England, for example, the spectacular rise of Cardinal Thomas Wolsey was entirely due to King Henry VIII pressing the papacy to grant him honours. In other words, rulers did not really need the Reformation to exercise practical control over the church in their territories. And when the Reformation came along, some of the most important of them, the kings of France and Spain, for example, remained Catholic. At the grassroots level, historians are now sceptical about whether anti-clericalism was as widespread or lay dissatisfaction as rife as we used to believe. There were scandals and failings among the clergy, so again there is no convincing evidence to suggest that these were worse than in previous centuries. In any case, anger at the behaviour of individual priests did not necessarily lead to rejection of the church as an institution, still less to questioning of the Catholic faith itself. In fact, there is much evidence to suggest that lay people were deeply involved in both practical and emotional ways with the exercise of traditional religion. It was usually the laity, not the clergy, who were responsible for the upkeep and furnishing of the parish church. This was an obligation they took seriously, not least because churches were often symbols of local pride and identity and functioned as what we would call nowadays community centres. There is also a lot of evidence from across Europe of enthusiastic participation in the rituals and ceremonies sanctioned by the church. Devotion to the saints, particularly Mary, the mother of Jesus, was strong and could be seen in the popularity of pilgrimages to sites where images or relics of the saints were kept. Far from alienating people, the most important service of the church, the Latin Mass, seems to have been a focus of intense piety. This is not really surprising. At every Mass, the priest repeated over bread and wine the words that Jesus had spoken at his Last Supper with his disciples. "This is my body, this is my blood." When blessed or consecrated like this, the bread and wine ceased to be bread and wine and became, literally, the body of Christ. Elite theologians called this transubstantiation. But when the priest held up the white disc of bread, ordinary people knew they were looking at their God who had come to earth to save them. There were a few sceptics, people the authorities called heretics, who didn't believe in the miracle of the Mass or think that images of saints should be honoured. But such people were a tiny minority, scattered and powerless. In Western Europe, the most threatening heretical movements, like the Cathars of southern France, had been seen off centuries before.